Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Columbia Care's fourth quarter and full year 2019 earnings conference call. I'm your operator for today's call. Please note that all lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. This call is being recorded for replay purposes. A replay of the audio webcast will be available in the Investors section of the company's website approximately 2 hours after completion of the call and will be archived for 30 days. I would now like to turn the call over to your host for today, Gary Santo, Vice President of Investor Relations for Columbia Care.
Thank you, Rob. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us for Columbia Care's fourth quarter and full year 2019 earnings conference call. With me today are Nicholas Vita, our Chief Executive Officer, Lars Bosgaard, our Chief Financial Officer, David Hart, our Chief Operating Officer, Mary Miller, our General Counsel, and Josh Schneider, our Vice President of Business Development. Earlier this morning, we issued a press release reporting our fourth quarter and full year results, which we also filed with the applicable Canadian Securities Regulatory Authorities on SEDAR. A copy of this release is available in the Investors section of our corporate website at www.col.care.com, where you can also access a replay of this call for up to 30 days. Please note that the remarks we make today regarding future expectations, plans, and prospects for the company constitute forward-looking statements within the meaning of applicable Canadian securities laws. Actual results may differ materially from those indicated by such forward-looking statements as a result of various important factors, which we disclose in more detail in the Risk Factors section of our final prospectus dated March 21, 2019, filed with the applicable Canadian securities regulatory authorities and also found at www.sedar.com. We remind you that any forward-looking statements represent our views as of today and should not be relied upon as representing our views as of any subsequent date. While we may update any such forward-looking statements in the future, we specifically disclaim any obligation to do so except as otherwise required by applicable law. Also, please note that on today's call, we will refer to certain non-IFRS financial measures, such as adjusted EBITDA and gross profit margin, excluding changes in fair value of biological assets. These measures do not have any standardized meaning prescribed by IFRS and may not be comparable to similar measures presented by other companies. Columbia Care considers certain non-IFRS measures to be meaningful indicators of the performance of its business, in addition to, but not as a substitute for, our IFRS results. A reconciliation of such non-IFRS financial measures to their nearest comparable IFRS measure is included in our press release issued earlier today. Nick will begin his comments today with a high-level review of our accomplishments during the fourth quarter and full year, followed by Lars, who will provide an overview of our financial performance. Nick will then discuss our outlook and guidance for fiscal 2020, after which the team will take questions. With that, I will turn the call over to Nick.
Thank you, Gary. Welcome, everybody, to this morning's call. 2019 was an incredible year for Columbia Care. As we began the year, we were a seven-year-old private company with 13 dispensaries in operation across seven U.S. markets with a little over 750,000 sales transactions since inception. Through the support of our investors and the commitment and hard work of our team, we opened more dispensaries in 1 year than we had in the previous seven combined, doubled the number of markets we operated in. Our dispensary count currently stands at 35 with six additional locations awaiting final regulatory approval to open, bringing the total to 41. Regulatory delays for both facility and product launches affected our plans in 2019 and continue to drive timelines into 2020. But with the capital plan behind us and most of the regulatory approvals behind us, we're very excited about an execution-focused year. In terms of state, our successful launch of adult sales in Massachusetts resulted in significant overnight revenue growth. Persistent demand has resulted in our Lowell, Massachusetts location now expected to annualize it at a roughly $24 million revenue run rate, with fourth quarter revenue up 204% compared to the prior year. Adjusted EBITDA margins were roughly 34%, and annualized revenue per square foot was over $4,200 per square foot. With our Boston dispensary in the late stages of obtaining approval for adult sales, we expect Massachusetts to have a significant impact on our 2020 performance. We also expect Boston to be another strong performer. Pennsylvania continues to be an outstanding market for us, with revenue up over 91% since the first quarter of 2019. In the 5 quarters since opening, our Pennsylvania market has achieved a positive EBITDA, free cash flow, and returned our initial investment. In addition to Pennsylvania, New York, Massachusetts, also achieved positive EBITDA by the end of 2019, with another half dozen markets expected to cross over in early 2020. We continue to innovate in 2019 with the national launches of our CNC card and CC at home delivery service. CNC, as you may know, is the nation's first legal credit card for the purchase of cannabis products. And following a successful pilot program in New York, is now active in 8 jurisdictions: Arizona, California, Delaware, Florida, Illinois, Massachusetts, Maryland, and New York, and available online. The credit metrics continue to be strong with a 63% approval rating, almost $3 million in purchases, and less than 1% in bad debt. CNC has had a positive impact on the average basket size in both dispensaries, yielding more than a 20% average gain, and through our home delivery program with over a 25% annual average gain. And we are continuing to explore ways in which we can expand the program to the broader market by introducing partnerships nationally. Our home delivery service is active in 3 jurisdictions now, and while still early days of our national rollout, is already producing impressive results, as the average basket sizes are approximately 60% higher than in-dispensary purchase in the jurisdictions where it's active. We successfully launched our Columbia Care Platinum CBD products in the U.S. in both retail and e-commerce channels, and continue to see our presence in the European markets with the first sales of our Platinum CBD products in December. On the M&A front, we continue to be on track to close our acquisition of the Green Solution, Colorado's market leader, and with as many as 7 of our medical markets potentially converting to adult use in the next 18 to 24 months. The addition of TGS's expertise and product portfolio geared towards the adult use markets could not come at a better time. Towards the end of the year, we delivered on our promise to identify non-dilutive sources of capital, closing on our first sale-leaseback transaction valued at about $34.5 million. While we made out and accomplished all that we set out to do for the year, I am proud of the progress we've made and the position we've developed for the company going into 2020. With that, I'll turn it over to Lars.
Thanks, Nick. I'll begin by discussing some key items from our fourth quarter of 2019. Starting with revenue, we reported total revenues in the fourth quarter of $23.2 million, an increase of 111% over last year. Our growth was entirely organic as we added no new business through acquisitions. In addition to our revenue, our partner in Ohio saw an encouraging start with $1.4 million in sales from 4 dispensaries in their first operational quarter. Our gross profit before fair value adjustments was $5.5 million, an increase of $1.6 million or 40% over last year, driven by volume growth of our business and offset by production costs of some of our facilities undergoing completion during the quarter. We recognized a positive impact from fair value adjustments related to biological assets of $12.7 million, compared to a negative impact of $4.5 million in 2018. The increase was driven by higher capitalized value of biological assets. Operating expenses for the fourth quarter was $34.7 million compared to $18.6 million last year. The increase was primarily caused by an increase of $4.5 million in salary benefits and facilities expenses, $4.3 million in share-based compensation expense, as well as increased promotional expenses and depreciation. Our adjusted EBITDA for the fourth quarter was a negative $13.9 million compared to a negative $2.9 million in the previous year. The lower adjusted EBITDA was primarily caused by higher operating expenses. And as of December 31, our cash balance was approximately $47.5 million. Now turning to the results for the full year of 2019, our reported revenue for the year was $77.5 million, an increase of 97% compared to 2018, again driven by organic growth of our dispensary network and increased per-store sales. Once again, our reported revenue does not include sales of $1.4 million by our partner in Ohio. Gross profit before fair value adjustments was $20.6 million, an increase of 25% compared to 2018. We recognized a positive impact to gross profit from fair value adjustments related to biological assets of $16.3 million compared to $0.7 million in 2018. That difference was driven by a decrease in the fair value of inventory sold during the year. Operating expenses in 2019 was $129.8 million compared to $50.8 million for 2018. The increase was primarily due to $20.3 million increase in share-based compensation, an increase of $17.2 million related to salary, benefit, and facilities expenses, $14.4 million increase in professional fees, and $11.1 million in non-cash listing fee expense reflecting the consolidation of assets acquired in our reverse takeover transaction in April. Adjusted EBITDA for 2019 was a negative $46.9 million compared to negative $11.1 million in 2018, and that difference was primarily due to higher operating expenses. With that, I'll turn the call back to Nick.
Thank you, Lars. I'd like to take a few minutes to discuss our accomplishments since the end of the year and provide an outlook for guidance for 2020. Since January 1st, we launched adult use in Illinois, which has been an unmitigated success. We've completed our Aurora cultivation and manufacturing facility in Illinois, which is great because it gives us access not only to a retail channel for our products, but also the wholesale market. We opened our San Diego manufacturing facility, allowing us to introduce our highly formulated sort of pharmaceutical quality products into the California market, which is obviously a huge wholesale opportunity for us. We have six additional dispensaries, four in Florida, one in New Jersey, one in Virginia, built and awaiting final regulatory approval to open, bringing our total count to 41. We have received approval to sell flower in New York, which is a huge, huge step in the right direction for the New York program. We were approved to begin cultivation in New Jersey. We were awarded a dispensary license in Utah. We were awarded a processing and dispensary license in Missouri, subject to the completion of a management services agreement. We achieved the first OTC sales of our Columbia Care Platinum products that are manufactured in the United States but sold in the UK. We added depth and public company experience to our board with the additions of Frank Savage and Jeff Clark. And we established a strategic advisory board, appointing former directors John Howard and David Solomon as inaugural members to work directly with management team as we look at the M&A landscape and the opportunity set out there. In 2020, Columbia Care will continue the transition from its hyper-growth strategy to really optimizing the value and the cash flow characteristics of each licensed jurisdiction and really developing scale in each market. As a practical matter, in providing our guidance for 2020, Columbia Care has not incorporated changes in the regulatory environment, including the potential positive impact of any future transitions from medical-only markets into adult-use markets, despite our expectations and experience regarding several of our markets that are expected to convert in the near term. We are also excluding our recent wins in Missouri and Utah, as well as any new market openings, the development of additional assets, future M&A, and additional pursuit activities. In assessing the ramp for our newer facilities, it is also important to note that the markets that have been open for 12-plus months are typically providing positive EBITDA contribution before corporate overhead. Also, while on the subject of facilities, I want to mention that our efforts to optimize our dispensary build-out plans in Florida, where we are able to take advantage of temporary pop-up locations in place of traditional dispensaries, allowing us to reach our target population and optimize revenue with much less capital invested and an improved labor model. As a result, we've revised our dispensary count to 14 in Florida, all of which will be operational by the end of the first quarter, with an additional 6 to 8 temporary locations throughout that will be positioned throughout the state to complement our home delivery activities that will give us depth in each of our local markets. For the fiscal year 2020, the company expects the following performance. Pro forma guidance assumes the full year integration of the Green Solution. Excuse me. Standalone revenue of approximately $155 to $180 million, driven primarily by the continued growth throughout the company of the existing 35 dispensaries and wholesale operations, the opening of the six dispensaries currently awaiting regulatory approval, including new market launches in New Jersey and Virginia, and then four additional dispensaries in Florida, the completion of the second medical and adult use dispensary in Illinois, 6 to 8 temporary pickup locations in Florida. Pro forma revenue is expected to be in the range of $234 million to $265 million, so with TGS continue to grow their market share in Colorado. Gross margins on both a standalone basis and pro forma basis, excluding the impact of charges in the fair value of biological assets and inventory sold, are expected to reach more than 40% during the fourth quarter, ramping each preceding quarter. We expect to achieve adjusted EBITDA break even in the fourth quarter on a standalone basis and in the third quarter on a pro forma basis. A full year CapEx is expected to be in the neighborhood of $25 to $30 million on both a standalone and a pro forma basis, with roughly 50% of that occurring in the first quarter as the remaining 2019 growth initiatives are completed. We look forward to an exciting 2020. As of now, we've completed our 2019 capital program. We expect to leverage our fixed assets to drive profitability in each market. as well as on a coordinated, consolidated basis. The shareholder should expect our pace of activity to increase as we continue to execute against our desire to make Columbia Care the best in class and most trusted global cannabis provider with the highest return on shareholder value. With that, we'll open up the call to questions. Operator?
Thank you. We'll now be conducting a question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 from your telephone keypad, and a confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star 2 if you'd like to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment, please, while we poll for questions. Thank you. And our first question today comes from the line of Vivian Aver with Cowen. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
So, Nick, it sounds awfully prudent to not bake in any regulatory change embedded in your assumptions around guidance, but it does sound like you're constructive on the potential for regulatory change, likely, I would expect, weighted to the back half of this year. Can you just add some more color on the seven markets, probabilities, where you're most or least optimistic or encouraged? Thanks.
So I guess what I'd like to do is simple. The seven markets we expect to have movement, let's call it in the next 18 to 24 months, are Arizona, D.C., Delaware, Maryland, New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania. I think that there's been a lot of discussion about Florida potentially being in 2022, but that would really that's really sort of a question mark right now. Each one of those markets has different dynamics, but it's fascinating because you look at a market like New York, as an example, 20 million residents, 250 million visitors a year, that could easily become the largest market overnight in an adult use environment. New Jersey, you know, has a significant existing sort of, let's call it, base of residents, but, you know, significant demand for expansion and growth, akin to what we've seen in Massachusetts and Illinois. And if you may recall that it's been our experience that when you see this transition occur, revenue jumps almost overnight between 3 and 5x. And so it's not a sort of a really tapered process. It's almost a sea change. But then you have markets like Washington, D.C., where there are 600,000 residents, and people might not think that's so exciting, but they have over 25 million visitors a year. So now you begin to look at a market that is sort of in the same order of magnitude as something like Las Vegas, which is huge. And so the conversion to adult use opens up a whole range of opportunities that go well beyond the traditional definitions of an available market on a local basis. David, do you have anything to add to that?
I think the outline that Nick described in terms of the timing for all seven markets, I think, is accurate. It's hard to pin down the definitive timelines for some of those. I think Arizona, we know, is probably in 2022, early 2022. The others, I think it's sometime between the later part of this year and sometime in 2021. But, you know, as Nick mentioned, we haven't incorporated that into our guidance for 2020.
Got it. That's really helpful. Let me just ask a follow-up on this, and then I'll jump back in the queue. Just, Nick, as a point of clarification, just from a process standpoint in D.C., can D.C. actually legalize for adult use unilaterally, or can Congress overrule that? Thanks.
So it depends on who you ask. I think that the D.C. government believes they have the right to do that, but there are obviously sort of governors, let's call it speed governors, through the federal funding process that could inhibit the timelines. It really depends on how the ranking members on the oversight committees in Congress view. Obviously, with a Democratic Congress, we think that chances are higher than not. But there has been a significant interest expressed from a number of the D.C. Council members to push this through.
Helpful. Thanks.
The next question comes from the line of Matt Bottomley with Canaccord. Please proceed with your questions.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the questions. Just wanted to touch base on the availability of additional capital through potential sale and leasebacks, and maybe if you could just line up your cash position at year end of about $50 million, your 2020 capex budget of $25 to $30 million, and then the interim cash burns until you inflect into adjusted EBITDA or even cash flow positivity, and just if there'll be a need for those further sales and leasebacks, or if it'll be more opportunistic in that nature.
So in the first quarter, we've provided guidance, and we've talked about it in the past. We expect to close another sale-leaseback in the first quarter. We are always looking out for additional sources of non-dilutive capital. And, you know, obviously the credit markets have been interesting for a number of other market participants. And so we actually have met with a number of credit investors, although nothing has been disclosed to the marketplace. It's, you know, we have no debt currently. We only have cash. So the view of the company and what's changed is that now that we're done with our capital plans, our capital, the sort of the portfolio is fully built out. And, you know, as you see a moderation in CapEx going for, you know, going down this in first quarter and then again into second quarter, you know, as each one of these markets transitions not only to EBITDA but cash flow positive, we think it's appropriate to begin looking at the entire balance sheet, not just the equity side of the balance sheet. So we're going to be opportunistic, but there is, you know, we're also trying to be very thoughtful and very timely in when and how we bring in that capital. So I think it would be reasonable to expect to see us, you know, sort of continue to sort of push our balance sheet to be as to give us as much financial and strategic flexibility as possible.
Perfect. And then just another quick question. If you could just provide any more color, obviously it hasn't closed yet, but on the Green Solution, clearly it's a good chunk of your guidance for 2020. Looks like it's a good little operation there with respect to its margin profile. So you had mentioned in the release, you know, the ability or the plan to increase market share there. So maybe just a little bit on the dynamic of Colorado and sort of the pros and cons, I guess, of ramping that up.
So what I'm going to do is turn it over to David quickly to give some of the sort of the micro comments. But I think what you've noticed is that we've always been very targeted in how we approach each market and why we try to build a critical mass in each market. We have tried to target, let's call it the super states, you know, New York, Florida, California. But among those super states are actually markets like Colorado, because even though it only has, you know, between 6.5 and 7 million people, it has a very significant tourist mix. And frankly, it's the second largest cannabis market in the world. And so their leadership, not only from a manufacturing efficiency perspective, but also from a distribution perspective, has been overwhelmingly sort of scaled by their ability to interact with their consumers using, you know, technology and, frankly, having very well-recognized brands and product offerings that are very well-suited for those markets. And so all of those have contributed to their success. But let me turn it over to David, and he can sort of provide a little bit more granularity on what we would expect to see and how we would expect them to sort of deliver on 2020.
Sure. Thanks, Nick. So within their footprint, including the 23 dispensaries, we're opportunistically looking at 2020 to take advantage not only of the retail opportunity, but for the first time wholesale. They had a very successful outdoor harvest late in 2019, and therefore, based on what we see from a supply-demand perspective in the state of Colorado, there's still going to be a shortage from a supply perspective. So I think the TGS team is well positioned to take advantage of that. It's still a highly fragmented market with respect to market share, even though TGS is the leader. So we continue to think that organically there's an opportunity to grow the business both at the retail and wholesale level. What we've looked at in terms of the initial 2020 outlook for TGS is just strictly organic growth, both retail and wholesale.
Yeah, and if I could just add, one of the things that's interesting about Colorado is, and we've talked about this before, but their experience in Colorado going through, let's call it the medical cycle, and then the first phases of the adult use cycle, and now more of a sort of a moderation in the sort of the pricing volatility and the operating environment. That's a cycle we would expect to see occur in every one of our markets that's converting from medical to adult use. So the skill set that they've developed to sort of not only capture a leading market share, but drive margins, drive cash flow, and then drive innovation. All of that is transferable into our new markets, and we're already beginning to see some of those insights taper into other markets and sort of really begin to have an impact on the way we sort of think about businesses, the business going forward.
Great. Thanks, guys.
Our next question comes from the line of Andrew Semple with Echelon Wealth Partners. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Just wanted to see if you guys had any additional color on the vape ban in Massachusetts. Obviously, that's behind us now, but wondering if there's going to be any kind of normalization impact on gross margins in Q1.
Do you want to start?
Yeah, this is David speaking. I think, you know, our business in Massachusetts continues to see improvements in the gross margin line. Internally, that's a result of us bringing new canopy online and improved yields. So I think the data point that everyone's looking at in Massachusetts is what the wholesale market pricing is going to do in 2020, and I think that's going to be a reflection of the incremental canopy that is going to or not going to come online in 2020. We continue to see demand across all of the categories, all of the SKUs, without question. And so we're reasonably we're optimistic about the gross margin profile for our business in Massachusetts on a year-over-year basis, 19 heading into 2020.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, Massachusetts is a good metaphor for what we're seeing in a number of our markets where we've seen new cultivation and manufacturing capacity come online, whether it's California, Ohio. You go through the laundry list of all the capital projects we completed in 2018 and then in the first part of 2020. Those results ought to, and in Florida, those results will now begin to really sort of reap benefits in a material way. So, one of the main drivers of cash flow for us is going to be to sort of isolate low-hanging fruit of the gross margin line and then push it down through the income statement.
Great. Thanks for the color there. With respect to New York taking a hard look at adult use sales, is that a marketplace where you may look to add cultivation capacity kind of within a 12-month time frame? I believe you hold an option for an additional 180,000 square feet at your current location, or is that something where you would prefer to see the regulations come out first before making a decision?
You know, it's funny. We've always tried to be very prudent in spending on cultivation and manufacturing. The return profile is very high, but what we don't want to be stuck with is sort of a Taj Mahal that we're unable to leverage over the long period. Over a longer time horizon, New York, and in fact, many of the East Coast markets have an undersupply issue right now, even in the medical setting. So, for example, if you look at New Jersey, it's critically undersupplied. So, our plan, to the extent that we end up making any additional decisions to expand our cultivation, let's call it the second half of this year, it would be exactly in New York. It would be in New Jersey. It would be in the states that are transitioning, so that we don't run into the same supply and gross margin issues that we've encountered in places like Illinois and Massachusetts. Now, it's a good problem to have because, you know, anytime demand outstrips supply, that's fundamentally positive. But we obviously, because we're the market leader in a place like New York, we want to make sure we use the transition as an opportunity to actually solidify our position and consolidate, you know, additional market share. So we are, I think the short story is we are looking to expand, and whether it's at that at our existing facility or by combining other facilities into the portfolio, we're going to be very opportunistic.
Okay, appreciate the color there. With respect to your CNC card, is that something where we can say it is in all your dispensaries today, or is that a deployment that is still ongoing? And if you've got any updates on kind of the consumer uptake of that, that would be appreciated.
A couple of things. So it's ongoing, and we're rolling it out. We haven't really invested a lot into marketing yet. We just finished a rebranding exercise that we will be unveiling in the second quarter. But part of that process involves bringing on partners, and so we've had a number of conversations with some large operators, in individual states and multi-states technology platform providers, and so this is really graduated beyond being simply a Columbia Care sort of platform piece. We think this is much better served as being an opportunity for the entire market, not only B2C, but also B2B, especially in markets like California, where everyone is getting destroyed by working capital issues. This could be a major sort of pivot point for the industry. And so, there are more to come on those specific details, but we've been working on this very quietly behind the scenes, and we're very excited about it because in each market, there's been an organic pickup, and the trend line has been the same across all of the major statistics in terms of performance and contribution, and the numbers just speak for themselves. So we're thrilled that we're at the point we're at, and frankly, we think it's going to have a big impact nationally.
Great. That's all on my end. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question is from the line of Jason Zandberg with PI Financial. Please proceed with your questions.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Looking at your guidance for CapEx in 2020, just wanted to know if you could provide, you know, what the priorities are of that that CapEx, given you know, a significant drop down from what you spent in 2019. Just wanted to kind of get an idea of where you expect to deploy that money.
So the sort of in the first quarter, it's really to pay the bills for everything we finished up in 2019. So it's just to, you know, sort of odds and ends left over to sort of perfect infrastructure build out. But for the rest of the year, it's really maintenance CapEx. There may be some projects here and there. For example, you know, the additional dispensary in Illinois, maybe you know, for example, we just found out we were able to open up 5 more dispensaries in Virginia. So there's no shortage of potential uses, but what we're really focused on right now is allocating capital into markets where we think we can drive cash flow fastest. So, for example, one of the prior callers asked about New York. Our view is that by leaning into New York in advance of a transition to adult use, we can really outperform a lot of our competitors, and we can really drive cash flow from operations and scale. And so it really becomes a question of prioritization rather than sort of opportunity set. And the prioritization today is to lean into markets that are going through that transition process, because we know what a profound impact that has, not only at the local level, but at the corporate level. Lars, do you have anything to add to that?
The only thing I'll just add is per Nick's earlier comment, we're wrapping up our cultivation in New Jersey and in Virginia, right? So that's all getting ready for the approvals that we just received.
Okay, great. And then would it be possible to break out wholesale revenue in Q4 and sort of what your I assume it's not that much in Q4, but sort of what your expectations are for 2020 for wholesale versus the retail revenue?
So we have not expected much in the way of wholesale. I think that we've had a sort of an interesting dynamic where everything we've been able to sell, everything we've been able to make, we sell. And so we would like to enter the wholesale market, but we haven't had the productive capacity. We haven't found that magical balance where we have excess capacity to sell into the wholesale market. So I think that for now, it's safe to assume that we are thinking about the business as sort of, leveraging our own resources first. But it is something if for example, if we do scale into New Jersey, or if we do scale into one of our other markets where there's a robust wholesale market, Ohio is a perfect example. I think you might see some increases in wholesale year over year, as well as in places like California. But that's the main driver of the business are really the things that we can control directly, and then everything else is kind of gravy on top. David and Lawrence, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I would say there's certain markets like Illinois where there's a regulatory requirement coming out of our cultivation manufacturing to provide a portion of our capacity to the market. So we'll certainly have it there. In California, we have expectations in our 2020 relative to the production that's come online in San Diego. It's not just going to be to our own dispensary. So I think you covered most of the markets where we have the opportunity. But again, it's going to be in our forecast. It's a small portion of our 2020 revenue guidance.
Yeah. Okay, great. And then just if I could, one last one. Just, a number of cannabis companies have had supply chain disruptions for their vape hardware. Any supply chain disruption given the coronavirus and, the lack of flow from China to the U.S. at this point?
Coronavirus? What's that?
Uh-huh.
Heard of it. No, we have. Thankfully, we haven't had any issues. So far so good.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
But you do bring up. You did. I feel like I almost feel obligated to say this. What I can tell you is that we've been delighted in the way that the business has performed throughout the first quarter so far. Our guidance obviously does not include any effect of Corona, but I'm. Frankly, I'm more worried about the regular flu at this point than Corona. So, we'll stay tuned.
Thank you. Our next question is from the line of Scott Fortune with Roth Capital. Please proceed with your questions. Mr. Fortune, please go ahead with your questions.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. Sorry about that. I just want to dig into Florida a little bit. I know you opened up dispensaries there, and now kind of looking at the pop-up model, and then how does home delivery and your cultivation work from building out Florida going forward? Kind of just the strategy around that now.
Sure. This is David. So we did invest a significant amount of our capital in 2019 into the Florida market. We're actually getting the final inspection for a large portion of incremental canopy that's going to come online, indoor canopy in our Lakeland, Florida facility. So we're still very comfortable with what we have in terms of cultivation and manufacturing capacity relative to what we've now built, which is 14 dispensaries for the market. With respect to home delivery, we are going to be very strategic in how we roll that out. Similar to what we did in New York, which was essentially zip code by zip code. This is all about hyper-local competition, and so we are identifying which dispensaries we will start home delivery from first, and then we will roll out from there. I think we understand the economics of home delivery and how that should be rolled out on a facility-by-facility basis, but our intent is to do that in the state of Florida.
And Scott, just one other thing to add to David's comments. You know, what we've found is that home delivery works best when you have credit. People don't like to pay for things in cash when someone comes to their front door. And so one of the exciting parts about the home delivery platform we're introducing in Florida is that we can, you know, basically create an automatic fulfillment model, which is a little bit different than what people are used to, where we can schedule around them and their availability, and it becomes a cashless transaction. That's one of the way we try to kind of build local ecosystems using the different services and products.
And then real quick, I'll follow the pop-up then strategy is kind of to seed that area where you're doing a pop-up and then see if it makes sense going forward to add a dispensary there, kind of just putting a pause or a hold on the expense side build-out from that standpoint?
Well, there are some markets where they're simply inaccessible to dispensaries, and so it's not only an opportunity to test the market before you make real capital, permanent capital commitments, but frankly, it's a much less invasive labor model, an operating model, cost structure. So it gives us the ability to sort of flex into to sort of test the market and make sure we're in the right locations. I think that's something that a lot of people have learned the hard way in regions and in municipalities they may not have local expertise in. They build, you know, these dispensaries and they end up not being in the right spot. We're very happy with the locations we have, but what we'd like to do is take advantage of this this regulatory opportunity and not only sort of find a more capital efficient way to drive revenue, but also really perfect the location before we sort of create a permanent structure.
Okay, thanks for the color. Appreciate it.
The next question comes from the line of Russell Stanley with Beacon Securities. Please proceed with your question.
Good morning. Just to build on the Florida update and those temporary locations, can you talk about what, I guess the CapEx is quite limited on a per location basis. Can you fill us in on the details there with respect to or comparing that to a traditional brick and mortar location? And can you talk about whatever sort of permitting differences there are in setting up a pop-up location and how easily that can be kind of taken down and moved to another location as part of the testing process you mentioned?
Yeah, this is David. So at a very high level, you know, the way we've modeled out the temporary location is essentially a delivery from an existing dispensary. And so you can have scheduled deliveries on an everyday basis at a temporary location. And so the CapEx that's required is very minimal. You're talking about some security. You're not talking about a full build out for a dispensary and the staffing associated with it. So it's very minimal. And it does need to originate from one of our existing dispensaries. And so we're looking at the proximity from our existing dispensaries and finding ideal locations that at times perhaps is not actually taking on a full-blown lease. It's working with a local partner to have what would feel like a modified sublease. So the CapEx and the OpEx associated with it is very minimal relative to a full build-out of a dispensary.
Okay, and how do the permitting requirements compare then? How easily is it for you to move around within a given city?
So I think it depends on the municipality, but what we found is that because it's not a fixed structure or a permanent structure, it offers a lot more flexibility from a zoning perspective. Obviously, you know, each town, each city has its own peculiarities and its own leadership and its own interpretations, but it definitely offers additional flexibility that we wouldn't have with a permanent structure that would have to go through a normal ZBA approval process or a normal permitting process for the certificate of occupancy.
Thanks for that. And just moving on, if I could, to Utah and Missouri, I know that they're not in your guidance, but could you talk about your options there, what the CapEx might be to build those out, and when we could see those become operational?
So it's really a second half issue for us. We're not focused. We have so much on our plate right now, and we're really focused on driving profitability within each market. Obviously, you know, when we went through our board approval process to release guidance, there was one very clear message that I received from my board, and that was, if you're going to give guidance, you better find a way to either meet or beat, and meeting isn't really an option. So we're going to do our best to sort of really execute on what we have. We are delighted to be part of the Utah program, and we're delighted to be part of the Missouri program, and we plan on bringing our very best resources and people into those markets, but we really haven't given much guidance yet in terms of CapEx or OpEx or timing, other than that it'll be the latter half of the year before we engage there, and that's simply because we want to make sure we can really focus on them effectively.
Great, thanks for the color.
Sure.
Our next question comes from the line of Graham Cranler with A Capital. Please proceed with your question.
Yeah, hi, good morning, and thanks for taking my questions. I just wanted to go back quickly to the guidance as well as the pro forma with respect to TGS. Looking through the numbers, the way I'm thinking about it is, at the time of the transaction, you guys had mentioned a 1.6 2020 revenue transaction multiple, which implied about, I think, $87.5 million of contribution in 2020. Looking at the bridge on the pro forma here, the range for TGS looks like it's closer to $80 to $85 million. So I was just curious in terms of, slight changes in estimates, especially considering that Colorado has had a record year in terms of the overall growth in the market there on sales. So just want to get some color there. Thanks.
So what I can tell you is that this is the first formal guidance we've provided. So I would start at that point, and I think, you know, hopefully you heard my sort of context relative to the board's sort of overview of how we provide sort of formal guidance on behalf of the company. TGS has seen this as a market leader, has had strong performance so far year to date, and we expect that to continue. The rising tide raises all ships, but they've managed to outperform competitors based on their execution ability and based on, frankly, their entrance into the wholesale market. So if we're going to provide guidance, and we want to make sure we provide guidance that we can meet or beat, and I think I would just leave it at that.
Okay, understood. Thanks. And then just to follow up with respect to the comments previously on the call on the retail wholesale split, as it relates to TGS, you know, quite a significant amount of productive capacity on the cultivation side as well as the manufacturing and processing side of things. So I just want to clarify whether those comments were more on the core Columbia Care side of things, or they were speaking more on a pro forma basis. And with respect to that CapEx guidance, does that mean that it's really just maintenance CapEx for TGS moving forward? Thanks.
For TGS, it's really just maintenance CapEx. I think that's one of the things we found so interesting about them as an organization. By the time we had sort of, let's call it, announced the transaction, they had really completed the bulk of a major capital program, very similar to the one that we were involved with. They were focused on increasing productive capacity and really reducing that cost per gram on a dry weight equivalent basis and their productive efficiencies. all of that has been a source of real value for TGS on a standalone basis, and we think that know-how can be translated into Columbia Care. But Columbia Care, when we think about our productive capacities and we think about what we target internally from a grams per square foot on a dry weight equivalent basis, we target between 60 and 65 grams per square foot on a dry weight equivalent basis. And we target over a little over five harvests a year. And so, we happen to have a very efficient indoor growing capability. They have a very proficient capability that is both indoor and outdoor, and it's multi-level. So I think the combination is going to be very strong.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Vivian Ever with Cowen. Please proceed with your questions.
Hi, thank you for the follow-up. Nick, I just wanted to dig in on your CBD launch in the U.S., if you could provide some context, number one, on the store distribution penetration. Like, do you have a number of FDM outlets you're already in, and what are you targeting for 2020? So that's kind of question number one on CBD. Question number two is, how much CBD revenue is embedded in your full-year revenue guidance? Thanks.
Thanks, Vivian. So we really haven't projected much contribution from CBD at all. Our products are great, and they're getting traction. But candidly, what we have found is that the traditional retail model is not that attractive relative to the traditional, to sort of the more traditional business that we're in, which is the THC side of the business. And so it doesn't really add a lot either to the bottom line or to the top line to get involved in some of these mass retailers. Because, three SKUs a month, five SKUs a month, on an ongoing basis doesn't move the needle when you're talking about a business with a revenue base of over $200 million. And so we've looked at all the options. We've looked at, frankly, a lot of the structures that competitors have adopted. We've looked at the profitability. And if the number one goal this year is to drive cash flow from operations up to the parent company to transition not only to EBITDA positive, but cash flow from operations positive, most of our resources and focus is going to be spent on the THC side of the business, or let's call it the RX side of the business. For us, CBD is a natural extension, and it's an entry point for a lot of people that are gaining confidence and comfort moving into the cannabinoid phenomena. But in the U.S. markets, I know that everyone likes to talk about an Oreo with a CBD in it. We just don't see that happening, especially now that so many of the Canadian companies have had issues. I think there's a reluctance among some of the larger players to really lean into CBD until there are real federal guidelines in the U.S. So it is something that we think about. It's something that we have sort of expertise in, and it's something that we're taking advantage of opportunistically. But it's not going to be a real driver of the business, and it's not something we're really hanging our hat on, for the time being. If something changes, we'll certainly let you know and let the market know. But it's just they're much, much more profitable, much more high growth opportunities for us to focus on in our core markets.
Understood. That seems reasonable. Thank you.
Thank you. At this time, we've reached the end of our allotted time for questions and answers, and I will turn the floor back to Nick Vita for closing comments.
Great. I just wanted to thank everybody on this phone and frankly thank the team for their hard work. It has been a whirlwind year, and nothing is ever perfect. You see markets like this and you wonder, is the sky falling? And it's not. We've seen really, really spectacular performance out of the assets we've built. We're excited about this year. We're delighted to finally give sort of, real thoughtful guidance to the marketplace. And on behalf of the team, we'd like to express our gratitude for all of your support. So thanks very much.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference. You may disconnect your lines at this time. Thank you for your participation.